This afternoon, we'll be visiting with Wes Preeb, talking about his early recollections of Holden Village. This is November 13th, 1983. Wes, why don't you start with the very first connection you had with what we now know as Holden Village?
As I remember, I was in Anchorage, Alaska, when I saw an article in a newspaper, the Anchorage Times, that the mine was closing and miners were leaving the village. So I wrote a letter to the Howe Sound Mining Company from Anchorage. I was standing on a street corner in Anchorage, Alaska, waiting for a car to pick me up to take me on a church picnic on a Sunday afternoon, when I put a quarter in a newspaper box and took the newspaper out and saw this article that the mine was closing. So I wrote to the Howe Sound Company, and the letter was answered from Chelan, Washington. Mr. Daniel J. Roper, who was closing out the mine, had an office in Chelan, Washington in 1957, and he answered from Chelan. He wrote that the mine was for sale for $100,000. So then the answer was received, and so then in 1958, I wrote another letter to the Howe Sound Company from the Lutheran Bible Institute in Seattle. Another reply was received from Mr. Roper, who was still in Chelan, that the property was for sale for $100,000. The property was also advertised as being offered at $100,000 under the Preview's Real Estate Company listing, number 65006. I wrote another letter from Seattle, Washington, from the Lutheran Bible Institute in April of 1960. They wrote back that it was for sale for $100,000. However, they answered that they were willing to give the property away to the Lutheran Bible Institute and asked that I would be a temporary caretaker till it was formally turned over to the Lutheran Bible Institute. Later, 3 weeks later, Mr. A.G. Kirkland from Magnum, Utah, called by telephone that they were giving away the Howe Sound Mining Company property to the Lutheran Bible Institute of Seattle, and that the company would send letters of title at a later date. The mining company asked that Wes be notified of this and that he be responsible for accepting various papers for the takeover of the village. It was with much surprise that this gift was received. It was received with doubt at the Lutheran Bible Institute, however, because of the magnitude of the gift. In the early days, I decided to look around to find out if there was anyone who was interested in this place, but found very few people interested. I scoured Seattle everywhere for people who had money, and finally there were people who were interested, and Mr. Gilbert Berg from Seattle also became interested through efforts of other people and became the first director and mayor of Holden Village. During the early days of 1960, the news of the gift of Holden was received with much skepticism, and one official of the church told me by telephone that we already had enough camps in the church and one more would not be necessary. And one person told me that the only thing you can do with this large camp would be to turn it over to the U.S. government to be used for a spy school. However, I was very concerned in the early days about money. Here we had a huge gift and no money to be provided for this place. And then it was in the fall of 1960 that David Thorson of the Seattle Lutheran Bible Institute called me and asked me, and I was to go to Holden, and if I would go there and watch over the property during the interim period before it was taken over. This was in order to protect the village from vandals and to generally look over the place. In the fall of 1960, I went up to Holden Village. It was a magnificent scene. I was amazed at the beauty of the place, the buildings, the deer grazing on the lawns. I was simply amazed at the miners' village with 105 houses still standing. And I cooked on a picnic fireplace alone behind Chalet 1. And I continued to explore this place and found many rooms littered with used clothing, empty cartons, of cereal boxes, so forth. The post office box, department, was littered with old cartons and junk. The miners' village, a short distance away from the village, located to the west, was deteriorating somewhat from the weather, but there were also many fine homes there in that place. Once a pleasant village of almost 100 houses, now an eerie ghost town with open doors and smashed windows. The remains of sleds, wagons, and toys stood in desolate yards. Woodpile for winter use were still stacked behind the houses. Deer were roaming and grazing around in the miners' village. The better built houses were still standing in good condition and showed little signs of wear and tear. However, this miners' village was burnt down by the Forest Service in the winter of 1962. There were many familiar incidents in the early days. People drove up to look over the village, and I remember a group of women coming up to look over the village. They came up in an old carry-all taxi from the Lucerne Resort, and one woman said that she had had enough of the looking. She said it was too huge for her comprehension and that she was too old to carry buckets up and down the hill and mop and clean out all these places. So immediately they got in the car and left and went back down to Lucerne. Many people ask in those days, where is the money coming from? What are you going to do with that white elephant? So it took courageous faith in those days to find the people, to find interested people, and it took much concern to, when thinking about this village, how it would be started, where it would go. And even the first group and the first director of Holden felt that it was a village with a large gift, like a baby coming into the world, but with little money in sight. And they had even thought about using only a few buildings at a time, because it was such a large place. However, I was rather depressed one day, wondering if anyone would ever take over this village. I was here alone. I went into the auditorium and I prayed about this because I had my devotions there. There was a large cross there from the mining days, which is still there behind the stage. And I set it up and prayed that someone would take over this village, that it would be used to the honor and glory of God, and pray that many people would come and use this place. But suddenly it seemed like the sun came through the clouds and the auditorium was lighted with sunlight, and I felt that my prayers were answered. And I went out of the auditorium singing the hymn, "Praise God from whom all blessings flow." And so today the miracle of Holden Village continues. Many do not know how this miracle is continuing because they do not understand. But Horty Christman, who has since passed away, gave his statement of his understanding of Holden. He said, "And if anybody tried to figure out Holden, they would spoil it." So he was wise in his sayings, that he felt that the future of Holden would rest in the hands of the many people who came here to Holden. Many feasibility committees came up to Holden to look over the place. And the first group of interested people came from LBI. And from the LBI board recommended that action be taken at a special meeting in 1960 to take over Holden Village. And then in September of 1960, a lawyer for the Howe Sound Company officially transferred the property and legal papers to the interim committee for Holden. The interim committee, as I recall, and appointments included Gilbert Berg, Luverne Rieke, Charles Morin, Pastor E.V. Stein, Dr. Donald Compton, Lawrence Puffert, Bernard Anderson, and Earl Ekstrom. The committee was later enlarged to include Victor Nelson, Dr. Wilton Bergstrand, Pastor Joe Bash, and Dr. Merton Strumman. The early interim committee came to Holden and felt that in order to be used to its maximum capacity, it would need national synodical interest and financial aid. The committee recommended that the LBI board turn over the village to an independent sponsoring corporation with a board of directors or representatives appointed or elected by the Northwest area and other national arms of the Lutheran Church. So Holden became a legally a non-profit corporation. And on February 1st, 1961, Dr. Luverne Rieke, a member of the law faculty of the University of Washington and chairman of the interim committee as well as the legal committee, and Charles Morin, a prominent attorney in Seattle, were a tremendous help in developing the articles of incorporation for Holden Village. And so many aspects of Holden were investigated under the leadership of Victor Nelson of Seattle, and responsibility in connection with maintenance and operation of the village. It was found that equipment operating over the highway would not be subject to state license fees because the right-of-way was owned by the U.S. Forest Service. Holden would be required to help maintain the highway along with other parties using the road, such as loggers and taxi drivers. The highway was constructed by the Howe Sound Company for heavy truck use in the early 30s, from 1935 through 1938. The paved street through the village was in good repair till 1961, when the salvage companies ran their caterpillars tracks over the edge of the pavement. The resultant cracking caused holes to form, which still can be observed today. There were many committees, as I recall, but I want to recall one person who has since passed away, who was here in the early days, Reuben Thompson and his dog, Bugger, who stayed here for years alone in the winter and skied down to Lucerne. I remember staying with Reuben here at least a half a winter, and he went on a vacation and I would ski down the hill to pick up the mail. One time I left Holden at 8 o'clock in the morning and decided to come back and return to the village at 9 o'clock at night, and was so tired that I could barely crawl up the steps of Chalet 1. And I remember a cook stove that which we had in that building at the time, and barely had the energy to chop wood to heat soup when I returned from that mail run because of the slushy snow there. We did not have the modern equipment then in those days. There was no equipment in the village except foot power and hand power. We washed clothes in a wash tub, poured dish water down the toilets, cooked in a cook stove, on a cook stove, and chopped wood by hand, and heated snow for bath water in those days. And living at Holden was quite primitive. Later on, Bertha Pearson, a very genial woman, came to Holden. She was selected by Gilbert Berg. She cooked on the fireplace behind Chalet 1 for many, many people, on an old cook stove for 100 people. A miracle woman in herself, who was able to cook for all these people on fireplaces and wood stoves in the early days. Finally, the committee decided on electric power. They installed a generator here to provide emergency electric power, diesel generators. They had the choice of repairing the 40-mile transmission line from Manson and clear the right-of-way with the PUD. The very expensive substation was removed by the mining company, the salvage companies, and so there was no electricity at Holden. They had another choice to develop a hydroelectric plant, and they installed a diesel power generating equipment also in 1962. So the third choice came up, and the diesel equipment was installed, and finally the hydroelectric plant was worked on between 1962 and 1965. There were many committees, interim committees, who worked on the telephone system, the telephone line which ran from Lucerne to Holden, a water and sewer inspection committee, a transportation committee under the leadership of Pastor Emil Kalovic in 1961. They decided that a flatbed truck and an economy model bus for hauling passengers and baggage would be needed, and a pickup for the village custodian. There were many others who were interested in working on the grounds. Dr. Eric Peel, one of the first men interested in landscaping from Mount Vernon, Washington, was in charge of a committee for grounds and landscaping. And there was an architect by the name of Robert Shervinek, who was interested in a master plan to keep the quality of the village high and the building standards high here. Mr. Gilbert Berg from Seattle, who was a fuel oil dealer in Seattle, became the first director of Holden and the mayor from 1961 to 1963. He spent a lot of time and money in the cause of Holden Village, and much thanks can be given to Gilbert for his work at the village. And finally, Werner Jansen came to the village in 1963. And was here for many years. And finally then, Gilbert Berg was replaced by Carol L. Hinderly, who became the second director of Holden Village. And so then the work and the programs of Carol Hinderly, many of them continue today, the lecture programs and many of the other activities which we have here at Holden. Carol was a dynamic man who felt that the village had a bright future and was willing to go out and pound on doors to raise money for Holden. On one of the first visits that Wilton Bergstrand made to Holden Village, he was quoted as saying, "I have never been anywhere from the moment I arrived where I felt so completely apart from the world, and where I could so clearly see the world from which I had come and to which I would return. It's not getting away from it all, it's really getting back to it all, getting back to the basic principles of one's existence, and in this uncomplicated setting, have a chance to do some real thinking. The giant rides on our back. We carry our problems with us when we travel, but in this place apart, we can see the issues more clearly." And I thought about this as I look back on Holden Village and Dr. Bergstrand's statement that also when we leave the village, we are also able to see Holden more clearly than we did when we arrived. During the World's Fair, I recall, there was an open house at Holden. There was not really a formal program here. But then, Holden was an interesting place and fascinating even as it is now because of its bright possibilities for the future. And many people came here, and I remember the first people in the summer of 62, Al Doring, Professor Mayo Seyvold, Professor Albertson and Nordholm, Joe Belgum, Lawrence Gudnestad, Dr. Armin Grams. And then I especially remember the nurse here that summer, Fern Van Cura, who the first year was trying to move a pool table in the pool room with a group of workers and lifted the pool table and dropped it and severely smashed her toe. And so she was hobbling around the village that summer. So coming back again to Reuben Thompson and Bugger, I personally remember him today as a man of spirit, especially good humor. And although he passed away in spring of 1984, and I received some of his greeting cards and Christmas cards from Seattle in memory of Reuben Thompson, I believe that his spirit still carries on here. And as I wander around Chalet 1, I often think of Reuben and his great, gracious spirit and sense of humor and carrying on here alone in this place for so many years. I feel that the fireplace behind Holden Village has a great sense of history and a special history because I was the only one that cooked on that fireplace for meals. Bertha Pearson cooked for many, many people on that fireplace. And so I've always wondered behind Chalet 1 and stared at that fireplace to remind me of the early days of Holden when I was up here alone. There is a lot of interesting history about Holden. For example, I recall coming into the former Holden store underneath the present Lot 6 and finding counters, fluorescent lights, shelving, a former grocery store with many counters and littered with debris, boxes, and so forth. In the back of the store there had been a meat department, and there are still lockers this day in Lot 6, and they were used for the meat department of the store. The coin laundromat, which we have at Holden today for the guests, was used earlier as a sporting goods shop and later was used as a ladies' dress shop. The pipe racks, which the dresses hung on with sizes of dresses, are still seen and still remain to this day in that coin laundromat if you should happen to go in there and want to find the remains of a ladies' dress shop. The present store at Holden was used as a post office. The whole length of the post office down to registration office today had counters, post office windows, and post office boxes in them. At the back, toward the back where the registration is located today, miners tell that there was a variety store there operated by a blind man who had been blinded in his work in the mine. When I arrived at Holden, I remember the Koinonia Lounge had grilled ironwork over it. There were many, many counters in the present place where the lounge is located and the fireplace, and loads of Washington State liquor store receipts laying on the floor, counters and shelving everywhere in the lower part of that place. There was also a drive-in window with a sliding window and counter near the door of the front porch of the Koinonia Lounge. Since that time, a lot of work has been done at Holden. I recall the remodeling of Lodge 2. When Lodge 2 was completed, all the people that were at Holden at that time had a dedication of Lodge 2, and we all gathered around Lodge 2 and held hands. There were enough people to do this, and we sang a doxology, "Praise God from whom all blessings flow." Then much of the, as I said, village center had been repainted, and the shaft had been built in the back of the pool room, which was a poker room during the mining days. When I arrived there, saw a crap table, many slot machines in the back of the room. There was also, where the present popcorn department was located, a room with windows that looked like teller's cages and old-fashioned bags. And here they said that the cashier would pass out the money and the chips for various activities there in the pool room. I recall when the therapy pool was built in 1968 near Lodge 4, and the celebration we had in the dedication when that therapy pool was completed. Indeed was a joyous occasion too, and we all gathered near that pool to sing songs of thanks for the pool. And then in 1970, I remember we had a bomb truck here, and Horty Christman from Colville supervised the building of the vehicle bridge, the old swayback bridge, which had been used by the mining company. It was a very precarious operation, trying to put the logs in shape from the shore of the river and swing these logs across. But as usual with ingenuity, things are always getting done at Holden, and that bridge was completed. In the winter of 1971 and 72, Chalet 3 was renovated. And I recall the intensive work on that building. I had lived in that building before it was completed, and I always thought of it as a large, old, empty building. But when the building was completed, I thought it was completed into a marvelous piece of work and an enjoyable looking building to be in. In the winter of 1965, a heavy avalanche came down. I recall this avalanche. I was here in the winter. It took tons of debris. There was almost 5 feet of snow in the road. The area between Lodge 6 and the footbridge is an avalanche-prone area. It was a silent avalanche. There was no warning of its coming down. And over 6 feet of debris, trees, huge rocks, and logs were piled on top of 5 feet of snow. It took a fire garage away, the Howsound Company fire garage, across from the paint shed, and wiped it out. There was a Jeep in the garage, which was thrown out of the garage and rolled on its back down near the river. The powerful force of that avalanche reminded me that the mountains and are ever near us here at Holden Village. But certainly the village has been protected from danger all these years. It was an interesting time because many weddings took place in the early days of Holden. In September of 1966, Werner Jansen was united in marriage to Judy Meek. And it was quite an occasion, and one of the first weddings took place here then, and a great celebration. And I believe it was the beginning of the celebrating at Holden. Carol Hinderlee was a man of celebration, and he believed that in the Christian life that we must also celebrate and enjoy life along with our spiritual gifts. In 1969, a fire ravaged Chalet 2. I remember coming from the Koinonia, and there were very few people here at the time. And about 1 o'clock in the 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Chalet 2 was completely engulfed in fire. The windows were breaking. Fire came out of the windows, and it was beyond control. All of us had been here for lunch and dish teams, and I came back to that building where I was living and found it engulfed in flames. However, I remember when getting up in the morning and coming to work that the living room was covered with soot and the furniture was covered with soot, indicating that perhaps there might have been a chimney fire in that building. But then it is still classed as a fire of unknown origin. But perhaps that might have been a clue or an answer to why Chalet 2 burnt down. Chalet 2 had been a guest house during the mining days for important officials of the mining company. I recall it had a large living room, a master bedroom on the first floor, and two back bedrooms. It had no kitchen in it like the other buildings, and an upstairs with two bedrooms in it. A very fine building it was. It was a tremendous loss to the village. Then speaking of fire, the Holden Village garage of the Howe Sound Mining Company burnt down in November of 1976. I recall the huge orange flames lighting the sky and lighting the whole sky around Holden Village. The fire was so fierce that it cast eerie shadows on the Copper Mountain and practically lit up the village. It was so bright. So another loss, but another A-frame shop was constructed to fill the void there. Everett Mitchell of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer wrote this of Holden in 1962. He said, "The tremendous mining past of Holden has been left in its landmarks. In three man-made mountains of worthless copper, dust, and rock, which could be converted into an airfield, in a huge concentrated mill rapidly being dismantled, in the buildings left intact, dormitories, cottages, gymnasium, dining hall, hospital, and school, which are being reconditioned. In this setting once resounded the robust laughter, noise, and vigorous activities of a mining camp. Here walked and lived hardy, courageous men who went deep into the bowels of the earth to dig and blast out the precious ores. Their tools were picks, shovels, drills, machines, and dynamite. Here too many of them lived with families. Then for a period it was a place of silence, buildings and equipment shrouded in the ghostliness of sudden abandonment. But Holden Village lives again, its streets and buildings echoing once more with laughter and the hum of activity and singing. Here are men, women, and children whose instruments are Bibles, hymn books, altars, sacred vessels, and vestments. It is yielding a treasure beyond price, the fruit of the Holy Spirit. It is a place set apart from the material world, but attuned to the beauty of nature and the glory and triumph of life in Christ. As I look back on Holden and remember the days of the baptisms in the river, the Vesper services up on the tailings, the Vesper services up on the hill, I recall what a future, I said, Holden Village has. A bright future where many, many people can gather to be renewed and to be refreshed here at Holden. But still, in the understanding of Holden, it is not the place set apart. It is not the forests, really, that make Holden. It is the people who come here, who put the life and breath into this place, and who put the excitement, and who come with their talents and their treasures to give to us, who come with their love to give to each other. This is an important part of Holden. Although Holden is set apart, Holden is a place of refreshment, far away, yet always we keep in mind that the people who come to Holden are the ones who are the gifts to Holden, who put the life and the experience into this place. Without the people, without the guests, without the staff, we must remember that it would still be a ghost town here. And so then we have this place for those who would come for a spiritual renewal. As I look out today on Holden Village and remember the many, many people today who came here, the gardeners, Horty Christman, the great patron saint of Holden, who gave his philosophy to Holden and his spirit, to all others who were people of faith and humor and courage who worked here, proved to me that it is the guests, the people, the workers who come here who make this place. As I see it all now, as I look back on the early days of Holden, it took tremendous faith and courage to start this place. As I walked about an empty place and stared at all these buildings and wondered what would become of them, and skiing up and down the hill for the mail and the future of Holden. And then I have seen it develop into a place of hope again, to attune to the glory and beauty of God through spiritual times and through the beauty of nature. For all those who come again to Holden Village, as I look back, the many, many people, those who wondered what their place was here and why they came here, I'm certain found a fulfillment here and found they were able to think about why they were here and go away with a refreshing outlook. I remember back one day when I met a man on the road who had been a worker all his life, he said, and he had lost his wife and came here for spiritual renewal. He said he had time to meditate and to think. I remember her brokering. I met him on the street one day, a man of great wisdom, ingenuity, and he picked up a rock and said, "What is this rock good for?" And I said, "I don't know. It looks like a worthless rock." He said, "It is a rock of peace because it is so peaceful looking." And he said, "What do you do with a rock like that?" And I said, "Well, perhaps we can look at it. It is useful for that, or we can throw it." Another time, I remember the old pioneers, Oscar Getty down at the lake, who sat in his rocking chair for days and days, pondering about subdividing property there, or just sitting by the lake smoking his pipe. And he said to me one day, "Now that you people have gotten Holden Village, what are you going to do with that place up there?" And I said, "We can do something with it. We can use it for the people who will come there in the future." And Oscar said, "That's all right," he said, "but first, get the people." But Holden has succeeded in that respect, and we have gotten the people here. And so from past to present to future, what is the future of Holden Village? The future of Holden again is the people who come here. I look back and see the many people who got on the buses in the early days, those old buses, not knowing what they were arriving at, because many of the people came in without notice. They suddenly appeared on the dock and wondering what kind of a place they were coming to. I remember the many workers who came here. A man who was a gardener here, who was always shoveling ditches. A man of humor, Al Swihart. I was walking by as he was shoveling a ditch one day, and in his rare humor, he said, "Well, now that we've got the ditches clean, what else is there to be done at Holden?" All right, and I said, "Our work isn't done yet. We have a lot of work still to be done here in this place." I recall the many people who came to Holden in the pool room in those earlier years, and who were of great encouragement to me, because they said Holden was a place that they appreciated and they enjoyed. And it is still to this day, many people come into the pool room and tell me how much they have appreciated Holden Village. Then I recall the burning of the sauna in 1976, a sauna down by the river, and smoke poured out, and about 7 o'clock in the evening, the sauna caught fire. And we thought, yet another building. Will this village remain intact? And certainly it has remained intact, and it has been saved for the use of everyone who has come here, protected by the hand of the Lord. So that is my history of Holden. I feel that I have tried to give a picture of this place, the early history of Holden, the closing of the mine, and the future of Holden. But the miracle of Holden continues to live on. We can continue to praise God that He has carried Holden through. He will continue through the coming days. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for He is good, and His mercy endureth forever. Give some history of a certain doctor.
Okay, let's talk a little bit now about how the summer program has changed and how the type of things that happen in the summer have changed over the years.
Yes. In the beginning, when Holden was first acquired, there wasn't really a summer program. We had youth workers from the various synods of the church who came here. There was somewhat of a program. There was a formal open house here, really, in the summer of 1962. There were Bible studies and lectures and tours of the mine, as I recall, but there wasn't the same type of program as there is today, mainly because the groups that were here for the purpose of renovating the village, and were here for work projects, and they were interspersed with Bible study and lectures. And the first lectures were given here in 1962, I recall, by various faculty members. There weren't a great many guests here in the early days in those years, and so more or less it was a smaller community. It was not the type of program as we know it today, with lectures in the mornings. There was a sort of a vesper service in the evening. I believe Carol Hinderly initiated the first full programming at Holden Village. The first years were more or less work years, trying to get this village into shape, as I recall. Carol innovated many of the lectures and forums, discussions, vespers, many unusual vespers. He was one of the forerunners in the type of program we have today. The program changed somewhat with the philosophy of each director. Fritz Norstedt continued somewhat in the vein, the programs in the vein of Carol Hinderle. Different aspects were focused on during the John Schramm years, world hunger, undeveloped nations, and so forth. So each director had his own philosophy, although the programs were carried on similar as Carol Hinderle formed them, but perhaps with different aspects of focus in the programs. The people who came here in the early days were the type of workers who were enthusiastic in working here and helping develop the village. Then we developed into more of a guest program in the 60s, where people came here more for lectures, retreats, rest, and so forth. I remember the 60s, there were many, many people who were interested in hiking, and hiking was a huge program in those days, it seemed. And there were many other aspects of the change here. We have not had since the early days, the Vespers on the tailings, Vespers at the rivers, Vespers up on the hillsides, or Vespers in the volleyball courts, or out in front of the dining room, because perhaps our type of program has changed. I can say that the young people who have come here from the early days, who have come into the pool room, have changed. It seems as though the young people of those days were more radical. They were more in tune with the spirit of the times, more involved with the spirit of change in our country of the 60s. Then after the 60s, we have the war protesters, the young people who were afraid of war and the Indochina War, and it was those periods I remember that caused great unrest amongst our young people who were undecided about their fate in Vietnam and the condition of our country. And I saw a restlessness in these young people. The young people who came after the 70s then were more interested in education, jobs, and so forth, and more of a quiet life. They had evolved into a new generation, it seemed. And the guests had evolved into perhaps a new generation of thinking here. And so it is the people who come here also who form the atmosphere of Holden Village, and so on. As I look back on that history of the early days, I felt that Holden did indeed have something to offer to these changing young people who were living in turbulent times. And today we have another type of young people here who are living in times of the atomic bomb and all of the other changing economic and pressures and conditions in our country. So we have one change from generation to generation here. And so the young people who came in the early days are now the families of young people who are coming to Holden at the present. I remember one young man last summer who came to Holden with a wife, and he said, "Do you remember me? I came here with a youth group years ago, and we were a very wild group. We gave you a hard time in the pool room." And I said, "Well, what are you doing now?" He said, "I've settled down. I've married, and I am a salesman for kitchen utensils and kitchen aids and so forth." And I said, "Oh, you mean pots and pans?" And the young man said, "No, we never refer to kitchen aids and kitchen utensils and pots and pans. They are referred to as kitchen aids." And so he said, "In my business, we have to call them kitchen aids." He said, "Now, though, I have come to appreciate Holden more and the lectures, which I was not interested in when I was here as a member of a youth group, and I came here in those days." The type from various director to director, the types of programming has changed, the types of lecturers have changed to many different lectures, from theologians to professors who lectured on many different subjects from era to era. And so the program has changed, although the lecture format has not. We still have the lecture program going on at Holden today, as I recall.
Have you worked in the pool hall the whole time that you've been here?
I've worked in the pool room since the early days, since 1967. The way I got started working in the pool room, there was no one there to take over. And so I went down there and sort of supervised it. And Carol Hindersley felt, well, there was no one there to supervise it at the time, no one there to take over. And he suggested that I go down there and organize it and supervise it and take it over. So I have been working in the pool room ever since that time at Holden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. During the early years when you were here, is it correct that you stayed all year, stayed through the winter?
Yeah, there were times when I stayed here the whole winters. The first winter of 62, I stayed here with Reuben Thompson, the first director. And I remember he went on a vacation and was gone about a half a winter, and I was here alone then.
Mm-hmm.
And also the winter of 1965, during the big avalanche, I was here. And also spent the winter of 1967 here at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can we talk some about Lucerne mm-hmm. Resort, the boat transportation in the early mm-hmm. days, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. The boat transportation was taken over by, in those days, owned by George Pennell of Chelan. The Lady of the Lake was one of the only boat which was traveling, the old Lady of the Lake, which was traveling up and down the lake in those days. And then when large groups of people came, they would put them both on the speedway and the Lady of the Lake. And there was for some time that we were without a dock, because the Holden dock, Howe Sound dock, was torn down. So we had to land and drive our buses to the Lucerne Resort dock and load the passengers there for almost a summer, till a new dock was built on the site of the present Holden dock. The owner, the first owner that I met after the mine closed, was Mrs. Lindstrom. She operated the resort, and she was a very hardy woman and carried on in a very pioneer fashion there at Holden. There were previous owners during the mining days, but they had sold to Mrs. Lindstrom. The mining era was over when we arrived, and the Lindstroms then sold out to a group from California. Then a change was made again, maybe about four or five times, till finally the resort was turned over to Holden Village. The Forest Service did not renew the permit of previous owners, and so it was turned over to Holden as a gift. We operated there several years under a temporary Forest Service permit. Finally, the Forest Service requested us to tear down and burn down Lucerne Resort. As I recall, when I first came there, Lucerne Resort seemed to be more primitive than it was in later years. Perhaps it had been somewhat improved, painted, and fixed up by the time it had been turned over to Holden. There was a house by the Holden Dock, built by the House Owl Company, but when the Holden Dock was removed of the House Owl Mining Company, also the house was also burnt down. The era of Oscar Getty, I was fortunate to know him, a pioneer who lived at Lucerne with his wife Mona. He was a very hardy man. He had hauled ore out of here in the early days in the 1900s with horses and wagons, and ran a post office at Lucerne, and passed away several years ago. He always was involved in developing real estate while he was sitting down at Lucerne. And his wife also, Mona, passed away several years ago. Both very interesting people because of pioneers here living, and they told many tales of the mine and the mining company when it was in operation, how the miners would drive up and down those snowy hills in their cars down to Lucerne and rent cabins down there at Lucerne. And Oscar told of his experiences operating a post office and that resort there during the winters when the mine was in operation. He told of the big heavy snow here during the mining days, how it almost covered the village when the village in 1955 had over 600 inches of snow here, 50 feet of snow fell. There was a 20-foot snowfall on the level here. And he told about how Life photographers from Life magazine came here to take pictures of this village because it was almost buried. And he also had a copy of the Life magazine, which he showed me with the pictures of the buried village in those days. And then there was Dinny on the other side of the lake at Moore's Point. There was Gordon Stewart at Domke, would gather every Friday at Oscar's and have a meeting there, and they called it their Friday Club, and they would talk about the early days of Holden also. Denny is still a caretaker across the lake near Moore's Point, an old pioneer who drives his Volkswagen down to the boat when the boat comes in to meet for the mail. I remember Denny, I used to see him coming across the lake in his rowboat to meet Gordon Stewart and Oscar Getty down at Lucerne. I remember the schoolhouse at Lucerne that has been since been torn down with the blackboards, and how the miners, young people, must have attended school there during the mining days. Although Lucerne Resort, they said, was a very busy, hopping place during the mining days.
Are there times when you felt discouraged about the future of Holden?
Perhaps in the early days, because we did not rightly know the future of Holden. And during times of avalanches and fires and so forth, I think probably to me those were the most discouraging times of all, because I did not often wondered for the future of Holden because of these catastrophes. But Holden has survived.
Have you done much hiking around here?
Yes, I have hiked many places. I made many, many trips, hiked many times to Heart Lake, where I practically wore a trail in the Heart Lake Trail to go fishing. And I hiked to Holden Lake many times during the summers in the 70s and 60s. Hiked to Lyman. I recall one trip I made in the winter with a group with snowshoes and skis and a pack to Lyman Lake up over the heavily covered switchbacks. They were covered with snow. And I wondered to myself whether I could make it, but I did. And wondered if I should have been a mule instead of a skier or snowshoer trying to climb up to Lyman Lake in the heavy snow of winter. Also, I have been across Heart Lake, across the Heart Lake Falls. I remember a group of us went over there once. There was a huge tree across the river. We threw the rope across the river with a hook on it, hooked to a tree. One person went over and secured the rope, and we crossed on a slippery log and looked at the cabin over there with the tin on it, which often reflects from the sun as you go around the bend to Heart Lake. And I have climbed Martin Ridge in this area and skied to Lucerne in the old days and up and down, hiked on the trail across the river to Lucerne.
Back to that cabin at Heart Lake.
Yes.
Do you know who used to live there?
Yes, I understood that it was an old trapper's cabin during the mining days. It was used by trappers. I found in there an old bedstead and a cook stove. They were the only items in the cabin. And it was still solid, although in some places the chinking was gone and you could see through the cracks in the logs there. I remember the old cabin that was up at Lyman Lake. I would hike up there. I'd hiked up there many times. One time came up there and found it so full of mice that I had to sleep outside. And other hikers in those days talked of how they would go to the Lyman cabin there near Lyman Lake and find it more mice there than could be imagined. So they would also camp outside. But in the cold weather, I often camped in that cabin, lit a fire in that small stove up there. Also another probably old trapper's cabin up at Lyman Lake, but it was since burnt down by the Forest Service, no longer there at Lyman Lake. I had been up to Dumpke many times and also visited with Gordon Stewart there at Dumpke. I remember Gordon Stewart's famous remark. He said, "Holden was a great, marvelous place till you Lutherans went up there and ruined it." But and he had many comments, and also he was a good source of history for this area. Gordon Stewart, still living at Dumpke Lake.
Has the appearance of the village, the outsides of the buildings and the upkeep of the village changed a lot from when you first saw it?
Yes, when I first came here, all the buildings were a pale, faded gray color, and with snow streaks all up and down the sides of the buildings. And some years ago, all the buildings were repainted. In fact, they probably have been repainted several times. And so, but the buildings were all of a light gray color, all substantially the same. And we have made changes in porches and built a brick walk patio in front of the dining room. What was not there was all gravel. There was a road extending between the dining room, behind the dining room, all the way down to Chalet 3. But that was re-landscaped and covered with grass. The lawns, as I saw them in those days, were all burned out. There weren't any lawns here when I arrived because they had all died. They had not been watered, and it was only light gray dirt on almost all the lawns. There were no flower beds in those days here at all. No landscaping and so forth. And no loading docks near the dining room as we see it today. There wasn't a bell hanging there in between the trees at the patio. The history of that bell is very interesting. It was donated by the Great Northern Railroad, now the Burlington Northern, and it was formerly on a steam locomotive of the old Great Northern Railroad, and it was donated by a former employee of Burlington Northern who gave Holden Village the bell, which we have here today. Many other items, the rocks and the rock flower beds were not here, and the area was barren around the auditorium. There were no flower beds there, as I recall. The space in front of the auditorium had been used, and evidently it looked like for car parking, as a parking space in the summertime for cars. I recall living in Chalet 1, and it was completely different than it is today, and it seemed very open and more huge. But now, since they have repaneled it, fixed it up, it seemed more cozy and warm than it did during the early years of Holden. As I recall coming into the Koinonia here and finding rooms piled with clothes almost to the halfway to the ceiling, your old clothes, old bed sheets. This building must have been used as a storage place for old clothes and old bed sheets and bed clothes and old pillows. Some rooms were veritably stacked high with pillows in this Koinonia here. So that is the appearance of the Koinonia as I first found it here.
What were some people's first reactions when they were given Holden Village? I'm sure that, you know, you said
yes.
Some people called it a white elephant. Were people really skeptical?
Yes, they were. One person came up here in a car to inspect the village. I was up here alone in the fall of 1960. And he told me that no one would ever come up to this place. He said the reason for that was that there was no swimming pool here for kids. They would not be interested in this place. There would be nothing to do here. He said, what would the people do here in this place? Just stroll around here and twiddle their thumbs, he said.
How'd that make you feel?
Well, I felt that this place still had possibilities. I recall, as I said, the person who told me that the only thing I could do with this place was turn it over to the government for a spy school. Other people told me, well, there isn't any money. Where in the world are you going to get the money for this place to operate a place like this? And there's no electricity. Are you going to just have someone on a bicycle turning a generator to provide the electricity here, or what will you do? And then other people told me, one fellow came up here and told me that this place could be used as a nunnery or a monastery because of this isolation here, and that perhaps we should install a nunnery here or so forth. Because, yes, it was a little discouraging because there wasn't any money in sight, and there were many skeptical people. There were skeptical people in Seattle, very skeptical, and thought that perhaps this place wouldn't turn out at all because of its isolation. There was a lot of feeling on that side of the coin, that because of the isolation here and the difficulty of getting here, the transportation needed, that it would hinder the operation here.
Where did the money come from? Any big
In the early days, money came from people who sort of like passing around the hat, getting more interested people. Some of the money came from the registrations, which we had here then. And then in the early days, there was some support from the three Synod youth officers who contributed some money to the operation of this place. And of course, Carol Hinderly pounding on doors everywhere and going to, especially trying to find interested people in Minneapolis and other areas to support this place and come to this place. And I think the contributions from many of the interested people who came here and felt that this place had possibility, so they contributed to the operation of this place.
You mentioned names of a lot of people who have had an important role in mm-hmm. early Holden. Can you think of other people that have been very important to the village?
Yes, there were many other people which had a great part. And I want to give due credit to all these people that perhaps had been missed. Bernard Anderson, Seattle, in charge of the committee checking general conditions of buildings and wiring. Earl Ekstrom of Seattle in the Power, Light, and Telephone Committee, who headed that committee.
You said once that we had telephone service from here to Lucerne?
That's right. Yes, there was a telephone line here in the early days. And telephone poles with a line running from here to Lucerne, and the Lucerne Resort could call out, and they had a telephone line running all the way to Chelan.
Okay.
Although most of the time the telephone service was very buzzing with noise and humming, and you had to shout in order to talk. But this whole telephone line was removed. The telephone line running to Lucerne was removed in the early 70s. The transmission line from Chelan to Holden was still intact, but it also was required to be removed by the Forest. The Forest Service required it to be moved since it was not in use. And there was no one willing to use it, so it was torn down by the Chelan PUD. We also had a complete telephone system here at the village in the early days. Almost every building and many of the rooms had a dial telephone in it, and still remains of the dial telephone system are up in the warehouse. Parts of it might be still under Chalet 4, and this telephone had lines running to each building with numbers you could dial to the different rooms, offices, and places at Holden. I believe this telephone, automatic dial telephone system, was installed here in the early days of Holden. It was not installed during the mining days. Later on, the telephone system came in disrepair because of the heavy snows continually knocked down the lines. Then there was a problem. In the summertime, there were many people here, and we could dial a room or an office. No one would answer, because no one was ever seemed to be there, and it was easier to go and find the person than it was to get him on a telephone. So that system was gradually removed. The House Island Mining Company had a telephone system here, and had telephone booths in the auditorium lobby. There was a telephone booth in the pool room. There was a telephone booth in the dining room, public telephone booth, and was manned by an operator up in the House Sound offices. And they had a carrier transmission line system where the telephone voices were carried along the power line into Chelan. The parts of that system can still be seen up in the warehouse storage area of Holden Village. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Werner Jansen came in 1963.
1963, yes. He left approximately over a year and a half ago. He's now in Leavenworth, Washington. The last director of Holden, John Schramm, left the village in, I believe, in April of 1984. There were a number of directors here at Holden. There was Gilbert Burke, Carol Hinderly, Fritz Norstadt as an interim director, John Schramm, and finally Elmer Witt here today. There were many other facets of Holden in the early days. There were many pieces of equipment present in the village which are not here today that were used during the mining days. I remember the kitchen of the dining room when I first came here, all the huge heavy pots and pans, gigantic frying pans, a huge oil range running the whole length of the kitchen almost, which was later torn out and electric ranges put in. I remember the old dishwasher from the mining days that gave out, and finally they put in another Hobart dishwasher up in the dining room. The new ovens, we used the original house on baking ovens. And finally, a wall was removed on the west porch and the ovens were shoved in and the wall replaced exactly back as it was originally. And the same, I remember the remodeling of the Koinonia Lounge, the Orlos peeled the logs. Eleanor Orlo working in the snack bar, a very tragic history. She and her husband came here. He was an engineer for Boeing. He had planned to take a job at St. Olaf as a teacher. However, he was killed in a motorcycle accident in Seattle. He was a staunch worker for Holden Village. And Eleanor was operating the snack bar and came here year after year and gave her support. But several years ago, she and her new husband were flying a plane to Alaska, and the plane was lost at sea and was never found again, and they were presumed lost at sea. There was another man here who came to recover the pews in the auditorium. And through this he was rejuvenated, I believe, and Holden was a great help to him. But he had planned to come back and finish the pews, but he passed away and was not able to return to the village. I want to give credit to all these old timers who came here, and John Nyquist, who built the stone walks, who had a heart attack here in the 1980s, was taken away, and since passed away, but labored long to build the brick sidewalks. Omer Klein, who built the stone sidewalks here, now living in Salt Lake City. And the many other people here, Al Swihart, who was from Oklahoma City, who spent a lot of time here, gave his time and money here, came here and worked as a gardener and loved this place very dearly. And Horty Christman, who came here, who was called the patron saint of Holden, who worked here, who had a great love for the village, warmth, and who his humor, his philosophy, and his work here, and he was loved by everybody. And passed away in the early 1970s, but gave much of his time and labor here to this work. So I'm sure that Holden can be thankful for all these saints who labored here and gave their work and time, but now passed away. We are thankful for all of them. As I look back on the other people that were here, carpenters, electricians who came in the earlier years and continued working here, certainly gave of their time and volunteer time. I remember the crews who came here in the early days to build the hydroelectric plant under Henry Schwecke. And Henry is now not around. He's in a rest home, very seriously ill, doesn't know anybody, but he had the brilliant mind to build the hydroelectric plant here at Holden Village, designed a pipeline. And the many huge groups who came here on weekends and volunteer help, there was no modern equipment, there was no caterpillars, no trench diggers. We had long lines of people up and down the hill with shovels and picks, picking out rocks and digging the ditch to lay the pipeline. And one fellow working on the pipeline remarked, he said, "It looks like China, like a bunch of Chinese coolies, picking away building these trenches here with the picks and shovels to build this pipeline and to build this upper dam here at Holden." So much of the work in the early days was done without modern equipment. There were no bulldozers, no trenchers, no equipment, only arms and muscles, shovels and picks, hammers and saws, and muscle work to do the lifting of the heavy work here at Holden.
There's about 5 minutes more left on this tape. Any final comments?
I myself today have a very positive outlook on Holden. I am very encouraged. I think it has a great future, and we haven't scratched the surface here at Holden yet. That it has great possibilities beyond our vision and great new hope for the future and for the people who come here. And as we envision new programs here and new work, new opportunities, we can carry on and thank God that more new people will come here to carry on the work of Holden Village.
Thank you, Wes.
Mm-hmm.